Are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, what are you doing?
I was waiting for you.
For what?
To say you were ready.
Oh, yeah, I've been ready.
Okay. Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. Richard Wally is from Portland, Oregon, and he is my co-host on the other line of this podcast.
And Cassidy Robinson, on the other end of this line in the Los Angeles area, is also my co-host of co-hosting on this podcast.
Trying to find just different ways of saying the same thing every week.
I think that was almost
like Yoda speak.
It was, yeah. I vaguely go into that once in a while. If I watch anything, though, I kind of end up doing that. Like, I've been watching The Wire a lot, and I've been trying not to, you know, do faux, like, street talk. It's not good.
You should just try not to be super racist all over the place?
Yes. Well, the other thing, too, is, like there's a certain, like, aggressive timber that they deliver things with.
Yeah.
And for some reason, like, that's more contagious than anything for me. When I listen to like specifically that show, If it's other shows though, like there's certain shows I'll start like trying to mimic their like accents and stuff.
Yeah,
and it's not something that I do like. It's like something I almost do subliminally too, because I don't catch myself doing it. My wife will start making fun of me, and then I'm like, oh yeah, that's not normal.
So if you watch like a whole season of Luther or Sherlock in one day, then you'll start talking in a British accent.
Yeah, actually. Bruv was a problem for a while. I forgot what movie that was, but I had a problem with it for a while.
There was Attack the Block. There was a lot of Bruv in that.
Attack the Block, but we watched something else right around the same time, and it also they said Bruv a lot. It might have been Luther, I don't know. But I was having a problem with that for a while.
It's good to know.
Lost, there was a Scottish character that would say brother. In a certain timbre, and I'd always say it like that.
Brother!
Good. Yeah.
Yeah. Today, we're going to be doing our top 10 and bottom 5 of the year. If you're listening to this episode, that's what this is. We're not going to be covering the usual segments. There's going to be no Netflix homework. And there's not going to be a, you know, current theatrical review in here. So everything we're going to be...
This is a special edition.
This is a special. Yes, yeah, our year-end special. We usually try and have it out early January, if possible. So, and at the top of the show, I kind of wanted to just ask you a few sort of related questions to our lists.
Oh, you didn't tell me you're doing this.
Mm-hmm. I'm surprising you.
I don't like this.
Just some questions, just some easy stuff. What would you say was the best movie-going experience you went? Might have nothing to do with the film itself. You may have even hated the movie. But just as far as maybe who you were with or the theater you'd never been to before, or like what would you say was like one of the better movie-going experiences? Could be an old movie. Could be a new movie.
You know, my best friend, this is going to sound corny, but you're asking this question, is my wife.
Aww.
Yeah, we hang out a lot, and we like doing a lot, and we do things together, and we have this weird sort of stuff, tangential stuff that we share.
Yeah.
We really, like, seek out, like, horror movies to go watch, and specifically, for some reason, horror comedies.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite ones that we went and watched this year was Cooties.
Oh, okay.
It was at Cinema 21. It's this older theater that's over on 21st Street here in Portland. And they're kind of rinky-dink little theaters, to be honest.
Yeah.
And this is even in one of their... This isn't even in their main auditorium. This is in one of the side ones. But it was basically me and her, and I don't know why, but we just had popcorn, and just the movie was fun, and it just felt like a very traditional, like, me and her kind of date. And that was my best movie going experience this year.
Oh, you should definitely have her listen to this. You'll get a lot of husband points.
You go to hell. I don't play that game. This isn't for points.
Okay, cool. My answer to that question would be when I was in Long Beach earlier in the year, pretty early in the year, in fact, I think I went to a late showing, like a 10 o'clock showing. I think I was hanging out with friends and just decided sort of on a whim to catch What We Do in the Shadows at a really late showing in a theater I'd never been to in Long Beach, like in the middle of downtown Long Beach. And there was practically nobody there. There was just like a handful of other people. I think there was one couple and then like somebody sitting behind me. But there was something about it that felt kind of like midnight movie about it.
Sure.
And the fact that there were so few of us, it felt like we were in on something that nobody else knew about. And it was a really funny movie, and I enjoyed it a lot. But it was more just like the atmosphere of the experience added to my enjoyment of the film.
Well, talking about that whimsy, that always is something that's kind of... Because, I mean, when you get older, you don't get those as many moments of just pure, like, oh, we just kind of decided to do this. You know what I'm saying? And so So sometimes I think that can add to an experience, and especially movie-going experience, because anymore, you kind of have to fit them in, as opposed to like, oh, let's go watch a movie. It'll be fun.
Well, most of the time it's like, oh, I got to go see this, and then I'm going to have to fit it around this, and then my friends want to hang out, then I'm definitely going to have to do it on this day and not that day. So it's like it's become like sort of this job-ish type thing.
Oh, yeah, and I mean with the podcast too, because it's right, there's a show quality. I mean, I'm not a every week kind of guy. I wouldn't go to the theater every week if it wasn't for the podcast. Well, I might around here, but I'd go to some of like and watch older showings of films, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So,
which I also try and do for enjoyment in between all the stuff. But just that experience was one of those ones where I was like, I heard some good things about that. Maybe I'll go check it out. And it was just a late night showing, and it just felt kind of private and intimate in a weird way. And It was cool. It was a theater I'd never been to. It wasn't like, you know, it kind of reminded me a lot of the Triplex from Pocatello.
Oh, I miss the Triplex. Mm-hmm. That gives me a little bit of nostalgia.
There you go. My second question, kind of leading into our top tens, what was the best movie or the most recommendable movie you've seen that was released from a different year, like an older film that you just never seen before, but you caught up with this year? And you can pull it out of your ass. It doesn't have to be your official favorite. It's not set in stone. But what
the one that came first to mind when you asked that question?
Yeah.
A movie I caught up with, and it was from quite a few years ago, the 70s actually, is The Boys from Brazil. That left some kind of weird impression on me. it has a weird sort of, like, the characters in it aren't your typical characters. Like, even who you start off with, like, you think he's going to be your main character, and then he, like, dies. Mm. And it just kind of... It's just the weirdness of that film. Like, and it just... It's like a classic Hollywood, but then they do this weird 70s, like, violence, and then there's, like, these cheesy B-like movie qualities to it. But they play it very seriously. But it works very well. I really, really ended up really enjoying that one. And for some reason, really still sticks in my mind. But... And you?
Yeah, that was. I mean, that's one of the fun things about our Netflix homework is we always run into great movies that we've never seen, but we get to catch up with. But for me, I think the one I would have to say was in a film school class that I took the last semester of my doing my master's degree in Chapman. We watched Todd Haynes' Safe, and that one just really left a strong impression on me. Like, it's a very atmospheric movie, very unsettling, and it's a really, you know, seeing it in the Foligno Theater, which is this gorgeous, you know, 500-seat theater with gigantic screen, I don't know, just everything about it was, I wouldn't even say necessarily an emotional experience, but a visceral one.
Sure.
And it was one of those ones where I was like, wow, I feel stupid that I waited this long to see this movie, but I guess I'm glad I saw it that way.
Right. Well, I mean, when something hits, it hits in, you know, and it hits in the right moment. that can be crucial to a film, you know, because right. there can be some films where if I would have watched The Boys from Brazil, I even think a few years ago, I would have maybe rolled my eyes. But right now, it just had some kind of gravitas because it just
worked.
Besides just working, it just has it does a lot of strange things that you don't see in film. And even from that era, you don't see a lot of it. So it's just it's just a strange film in general.
Yes.
And so it strikes a tone that I aspire to. So
there you go. Okay, cool. Well, that just kind of whets our appetite a little bit, sort of oils us up for getting into our top 10 of the year. And we were talking a little bit before the show started, and I was like actually looking at my top 10, and I was like kind of surprised. I was like, oh, that's my top 10? Because I have to say, this has been a pretty weak year for me.
Well, we've talked about it, and like the thing is if we say weak, I think that's kind of both ends. Because when we were, I've never liked the bottom five. I've never liked, it seems excessively bitchy. Like, I don't think it needs to be done, but I do it because you like to do it. This year, I even like I had a hard time putting it together because most years I'm like, oh, I hated that film. This year, it still was even a little like, I guess that film.
Well, yeah, I didn't see as many films as I normally see. I think by the end of the year, I've seen close to 80.
Mm.
This year, I think I was closer to 50.
Mm.
So I didn't have as much money. I've been working full time, so I couldn't just like go on a Wednesday afternoon and see something down the street.
That spoils you. It really does.
It does.
Because those glorious like lazy Wednesday afternoon matinees,
mm-hmm.
you can't beat them. But you know, most people don't get that opportunity.
Yeah, and usually during the summer, and especially around this time of the year, I double up on weekends. I've been trying to do that a little bit here, trying to cram it all in, but it's just impossible. And I didn't see as much as I would have liked to have seen. So my bottom five, there pretty much was only five to choose from.
I had one in here, but I really almost it would have been the weirdest review because it would have been a bottom five, but I would have been defending it.
Right.
I'm glad that I remembered a movie that came out. I was right. Oh yeah, that fucker.
But just at the top, I wasn't able to see Joy. I wasn't able to see The Revenant yet. I think we'll be reviewing that next week, actually. I haven't seen The Gift, which I've heard was a surprisingly good movie. I haven't seen Brooklyn, which I've heard good things about. Never got to see Bridge of Spies. Was interested in seeing Magic Mike XXL. And never got to see Anomalisa, which I still want to catch up with.
Oh, I guess I should mention I should have seen The Martian, didn't see that. The Room, I should have seen that. I didn't actually have a lot of opportunity to see The Room, and then the other one you didn't mention was Spotlight. I never had the opportunity to see that one either.
I did see it. Yeah. It just hasn't, come up on the podcast yet. I wasn't sure when or where to do that. I might do that as a solo review next week or something.
Okay.
But yeah, let's go ahead and get into it. You know, why wait around? Let's go into our top 10, starting with number 10, working our way up to 1. We'll try and keep these short little mini reviews here, or little mini, just our impressions of the movie, why they're in our top 10. So what's your number 10?
My number 10 was Dope. It's just got a fun cast of characters. It's kind of like almost like a black version of Scott Pilgrim in a lot of ways. But what it doesn't do, it is set in a very hard neighborhood in the southern LA area.
Yeah.
But it doesn't like avoid any of kind of the ugliness of it. But it did some really, really interesting things. Like in the jocks of the school, instead of being jocks, they were like gangsters. So not being like stereotypical and being like everybody's like that in these neighborhoods and stuff like that. I thought it was an interesting and a really creative way of kind of doing that kind of story. Also, I think just because it was also done by a black director, it has some more voice to it. I really thought that the characters were just interesting, and it was a fun little movie.
Mm-hmm. It was an interesting update of sort of teen movie tropes that we've seen, but sort of played in this like kind of weird satire post, I don't know, Spike Lee post Dear White People sort of way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Agreed. I think it's just a fun one. Yeah.
Yeah. My number 10 is Steve Jobs. directed by Danny Boyle, written by Aaron Sorkin. You know, probably not the best movie that either of them have done. And it's certainly not without its issues here or there. But I think the strength of the writing is inignorable, and the strength of the performances, the entire ensemble of Michael Fassbender and Kate Winslet and Michael Stuhlbarg and Seth Rogen, everybody has a few big moments in the movie. And I more than anything, I was really fascinated by the structure of it, of taking three different launches of Steve Jobs' career and treating them as like one acts.
Well, it could be way too familiar. You know, mm-hmm. It's a subject matter that he's kind of done in a way, but the way that they present it, and I think Danny Boyle does a hell of a job too.
Yeah.
I mean, it might not be his strongest or his most energetic or a lot of things. But this is a more reserved movie for him, actually, talking about reserved films. But yeah, you can't beat the performances in this either. I mean, that Michael Fassbender, he's so dreamy.
He's just so talented, and he elevates whatever he's in. I mean, he's been in some kind of meh movies or even some pretty bad movies, but he's always a takeaway.
Well, we were talking, getting into Fassbender town. I was talking with friends about Frank a little bit ago.
Oh, I love that movie. Yeah,
I love that. I mean, it's a good movie too. It's not one of his bad ones, but the fact that he's under that stupid dome for, I guess that could be a spoiler, couldn't it? No, I don't think so.
No.
The fact that he's under it for like 90% of the film,
right?
And he still gives a performance. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah, he has a paper mache mask on for the entire movie. You never see his face, but he still somehow steals every scene.
His charisma just oozes through that. I mean, Steve Jobs, like, that movie's almost like it's hard not to kind of respond to.
Mm-hmm. And you forget that he doesn't look anything like him. You're just so caught in the performance and sort of the language and the pace of the movie.
Well, in the world they build.
The rhythm of the dialogue, you just you're so in it that you don't think about like, oh, these conversations never could have happened. And oh, he doesn't look anything like Steve Jobs.
Well, I'm sure there were people like that, but
right, right. Okay, what's your number 9?
That was one of my honorable mentions, by the way.
Oh.
Just saying that out there so we don't have to talk about it later. My number 9 is Kingsman, The Secret Service.
Okay.
This film takes like a very, you know, very done genre, the spy genre, mm-hmm. and just has so much fun with it and kind of doesn't play towards its conventions and doesn't really necessarily care that much that it's hard to kind of deny it. I rewatched it recently because my wife wasn't able to see it with her. And it was still just as much fun. You've got a lot of fun performances and set pieces. It's a Matthew Vaughn movie. Mm-hmm. And if you've seen other of his movies, you know the kind of stuff he can do. I think this is him firing on all his cylinders. Mm-hmm. And kind of you get some of the funnest like little like character interactions too, because you've got these kind of rigid, you know, white people. And then the fact that we're seeing a fun movie, but it also happens to be rated R, but it also happens to be like a blockbuster kind of tentpole, that doesn't actually, it's more like I was just starving for that. And then when I finally got a taste of it, I was like, oh yeah, that's what that feels like. That's nice.
It almost takes like that YA, like, a teen adventure genre that's so big right now, and then like subverts it and turns it into this like kind of mean, but in the best way possible, kind of punk rock kind of movie. It's just, it's, you know, I think we reviewed this at the same episode that we reviewed Boys from Brazil. And we mentioned that both movies are kind of cut from the same cloth of like, it's something you've seen before, but definitely in a way you've never seen it.
Right. And the fact that he just kind of goes there on the violence and on the language and even on the sex, and he doesn't give kind of two shits about, being
politically correct,
correct or nice or anything. It's just refreshing. Like, I mean, honestly, like, it's just like, oh, character, that's nice. Mm-hmm. Like, we get that in a big tentpole kind of film. That's wonderful. So all of those things brought it to my list. I mean, also if we're talking, I mean, it's got Samuel Jackson. It also has got Colin Firth. And even a lot of the young guys, even though some of their performances aren't always like 100%, they're still all delivering, and it's just a fun, rowdy movie.
Right.
So that's why I made my list. I really dug it.
And that would have been on my honorable mentions. Speaking of fun, rowdy movies, one of my favorite cinematic achievements of the year is Tangerine. This is a film that was, famously shot on an iPhone 5 and cost practically nothing, and somehow the director still came out in debt for making it. And it explores the world of these two transgendered prostitutes working in Hollywood. And it sort of becomes this crazy odyssey through, the seedy underworld of Hollywood. And it becomes this, rowdy sort of screwball comedy, and as seen through the lens of like a independent spirit. I just like this movie a lot. And I thought I had a lot of fun watching it. I also appreciate sort of the experimental nature of it and how it was made for so little. I always get a kick out of seeing, filmmakers going out there and like bucking the system and getting a film made however they can. And if the movie happens to be any good, that's even better. And this one is. And I think that it, explores these characters with real sympathy, but also doesn't like turn them into, the sad little protected pandas that so many people try and do with LGBT stories. These are characters who are living on the dole, and they are poor, and they are have hard lives, and they are treated unfairly, but they also get to be kind of crazy and bitchy and.
Oh, you mean they're people? That's nice.
Yeah, they're people, and this has this very outsider and on the inside kind of appreciation for this culture they live in, and sort of gives you this this peek into this world. He sort of turns this part of LA that we never really get to see in movies, because it's always about the stars or like the hills or Beverly Hills or whatever. And here it's like these are the streets you avoid. And we're going to spend 2 hours in it.
Sure.
And I just liked it a lot.
I didn't see Tangerine. I don't have anything to say. Sorry. I should clarify that. Moving on. My number 8 was The Hateful Eight. See what I did there?
I see what you did there. Very clever.
Not really. Really, probably my, from 5 to 10, they're pretty mixed up and interchangeable.
Sure.
It's pretty fluid.
Right.
But I did choose Hateful Eight to be on number 8. We just talked about this film at length, but I just enjoyed that it was a dark chamber piece mystery. Mm. I kind of liked that. It felt very traditional to me in a lot of ways. And the fact that you get to see Quentin Tarantino deliver, there's something about watching one of his films when it's right for you that just, it feels good. It feels like coming home almost in a way.
Right.
The fact that this film went as violent as it did, the fact that this film went as hard and as mean as it did, it stuck out to me. And usually I tend to be kind of hesitant about a film I just watched, whether I put it on a list. But I actually think that this one will stick with me just because of some of the performances and just because of this came up a lot in both of our reviews when we were talking about it, just the mean nature of the film.
Right.
It appeals to my type of film.
Kind of like Kingsman in that way, where there's a certain insanity to it that you sort of appreciate.
There's a manic kind of mean. Yeah, there's literally, it is saying, oh, okay, this is what we're supposed to be doing, but we're not doing it. I kind of enjoy that when I'm watching a film. And also not necessarily trying to be polite society or on the flip side, trying to be anti-intellectualist.
Right. Like,
I think films can be both and should be both. And I think that this film does that. Again, I just enjoyed it. Samuel L. Jackson is always a plus to me. It doesn't matter if he's in a movie about, flying airplanes with snakes loose on them. I will probably watch it and enjoy it. I like Samuel L. Jackson, so.
And he's really good in the movie, and it has a really good cast. Yeah. We did just talk about this at length. I appreciate it on a lot of levels. I would probably call this an honorable mention for me. And it's an experience, that's for sure. By the end of the movie, it's a strong cup of coffee.
And you know what? That does something for me. I really do think so in film. Even on subsequent viewings, when I can feel that in a movie, I usually enjoy it a little more.
Mm-hmm. My number 8 is The Martian.
Hmm.
Yeah, this is a big return to form, I think, for Ridley Scott, who's sort of been floundering a little bit in these gigantic epics and, you know, these period pieces and this kind of stuff that's not really working all that well for him. Or he's never really had a screenplay that really felt, I think, matched the ambition of what he does visually in a while, at least since like the early 2000s or so. But here's one where, you know, it's written by Drew Goddard or adapted by Drew Goddard based on a novel. And it's funny. It's been so long since I've been able to, like, appropriately laugh at a Ridley Scott movie, and not in the ways that I was inappropriately laughing at The Counselor. I
disagree with you there, sir.
I know.
Out comes the glove. Slap.
I enjoyed the hell out of The Martian. It's a lot of fun, and it's kind of the celebration of science and sort of, you know, the geeks who run this whole goddamn thing. And not, you know, not the Comic-Con I'm going to pay a bunch of money for belt buckles that look like Batman geeks. I'm talking about, like, the people who spend their entire lives in physics classes and, you know, figuring out, okay, so if we have this thing over here, how long exactly is it going to take? Like, mathematically figuring out things. And it's a celebration of intelligence and science, while at the same time being fun and funny and light on its feet and, you know, taking a sort of sci-fi premise and kind of creating a new sort of tone for it in a way. I enjoyed it a lot. Also kind of referencing old sci-fi with stuff like Silent Running. It's cool.
It's cool. I do want to see that.
Yeah.
It sounds also a word that seemed like in that strand of words that you should have been saying was relatable. And so that's something that's kind of...
Well, Matt Damon is a great everyman that, yeah, you know, people can project themselves into, and
he's got that corn-fed quality you just can't get away from.
And in a year where we've seen a lot of survival movies that are kind of like dismal and boring, here's one that, like, yeah, he's struggling to survive, but he has a good attitude about it, and there's a disco soundtrack to the whole thing.
Well, you know, there you go. My number 7 is also a survival struggle story. It's Big Short. We just watched this film not too long ago, directed by Adam McKay, normally known for his Will Smith, or not Will Smith, Will Ferrell, Anchorman, those kind of movies.
Right.
This film specifically, what he does differently here is he brings, I think, a real message and a real cause, but he doesn't force feed you. He makes you feel the appropriate amount of outrage that you should feel for it. He explains things. He does it kind of with a flourish. There's kind of a rock and roll style to it as well. I personally actually ended up really liking this film, even though it really still has left me very angry. And
not at the movie, but at the cause that he's bringing up.
At the fucking homing failure of 2007. Yes, yes, it makes me appropriately, and I think it makes people very angry about a situation that they, you know, that's what was out of their control. It's out of their purview. Right. They couldn't do anything about it.
And was kind of swept under the rug. Like, you know, it happened and we've all sort of been like, you know, it's sort of become a cliche to say this economy or, you know, things aren't as good as they used to be or the crash of 2008. But a lot of people don't really know what that meant or how it happened. Myself included.
Me too. And this film, I'm glad it does something that I think is, again, when I say it explains to you, it literally takes you aside with stars. And explains big notions to you that you wouldn't, this is inside information and jargon that you wouldn't know about.
Yeah.
And it kind of deconstructs some of the bullshit within our economic systems that do exist to purposefully do that to you.
Right.
That you need some kind of expert in order to navigate buying a simple thing as buying a house, shelter, a basic necessity. Mm-hmm. So this film incentivized me to be more angry than I should be still.
Put your fist in the air.
Yeah, fuck the man.
Fuck the man.
But I think the film is really smart, and I think it does show. I think it shows that Adam McKay does have some chops. Mm-hmm. I mean, as a director too. I'm excited to see what else he does continuing on. Also, I didn't say it in my review, but I really meant to. Steve Carell gives another great performance. He's a very underrated actor.
I agree. I actually think that I hope that he's recognized for that performance, because it's, I think, the standout of the movie, and he anchors that the emotional core of that movie, because so much of it is so big and moving so fast that you need somebody to be like, no, but this really does suck. Not the movie, right, but the situation.
Well, he galvanizes your hatred.
Right, yeah.
And appropriately. Mm-hmm. I also do like other performances. I like Christian Bale quite a bit. There's a lot of smaller side performances. This has a rather big cast, actually. It also has little things by Brad Pitt. It's
Ryan Gosling.
Ryan Gosling is a fun part in it. I ended up coming away being a lot more positive on this film than I thought I would be.
Yeah.
Especially it being kind of a message piece.
Right. Yeah. I think the difference between this movie and, say, something like, I don't know, what's something kind of comparable to it, like a 12 Years a Slave or something, you know, just something a little bit more prestige-y,
mm-hmm,
that has a message behind it, is this movie has less of a, you know, send you away feeling sorry, but has more of an activist bent to it. It's like send you away wanting to do something.
It sends you away, you know, and the other thing that it does too is it sends you away understanding more.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it educates you.
And it still really understands that it has to be a movie, and it still has to entertain you while you're there.
All those dots, yeah.
Right, it's a great satire, yeah, I agree. It's again, probably would have been another one of my honorable mentions, but it didn't make my top 10. About my number 7, which is Dope. I enjoy it for all the reasons you said. You know, it's a great teen comedy. It really understands the culture it's from, kind of spotlighting. I love movies that take an inside look into a culture that we normally don't see in big films, or done in a genre way. And, you know, seeing these teenagers grow up in Inglewood, California, and playing it like a high school comedy turn into a heist film. You know, it's just creatively written and has a lot of energy, and it maybe doesn't 100% all the time work, but it was one of my favorite, like, again, another one of my favorite movie going experiences, just because there was so much energy coming off of the movie that it was contagious.
Agreed. I mean, I think that's something that's kind of about a lot of films, mm-hmm, is when there are a lot of films, there's no film that I feel like is really, there's not a lot of films that are perfect. You know, I don't even think a lot of my favorite films are perfect.
No,
but
yeah.
This is one of those films that the positives just ignite, and you can't even worry about, like, the dross and stuff that might be attached,
right,
to it. So
it sort of accumulates into something greater than the sum of its parts.
Is there anything else you wanted to say about that?
Nope.
Okay. Well, now I'm going to get into a controversial number 6.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. The something might happen here. One of my favorite films, and I really do think it's a good film, I'm not trying to be mean, but I think you missed the forest through the trees on this one, is Krampus. I think that this film was, I thought it was a lot of fun and fantastic. I think it has some great performances, some great comedic performances, and I think that beyond just, like, set pieces and everything like that, it's a great Christmas movie. I don't think it was trying to necessarily just be a horror film or just be I think that those were kind of its side projects. I think it was trying to be a Christmas film. Mm-hmm. I think that in a lot of ways, you know, what I was hearing and was that basically that it wasn't funny enough or that it wasn't scary enough. To me, that sounded a lot like when people were talking about, you know, Werewolf in London. People didn't think it was funny or scary enough. But that's the thing about horror comedies, is they strike a weird tone. This movie has a weird fucking tone. I will not deny that. This film quite clearly wants to be kind of warm and fuzzy, but mean at the same time. And I think it does. I think it very much strikes that tone. And I think in years, I think this is going to be, I usually don't do this because I think it's only time can tell, but I think this will be one of those cult movies that people go back to. I think it's a lot of fun. I think, like, Adam Scott is great. I think that, some of the other, like, I think some of the kid performances are great in it. And it just overall, I think it actually did scare me more and made me laugh more than American Werewolf in London. So this is one of those films, I know we disagree, but it's on my top 10 and I really do stand by it.
All right. Yeah, I didn't have as much fun with it as you did. There was another movie that came out this year that was like a anthology film that had Krampus in it. Mm-hmm. I forgot what it was called. Do you remember?
I don't know. See, that's another thing. There's been 3 Halloween anthology movies, so that's a little hard, too. And a Christmas, specifically like Horror Christmas. It was just called Horror Christmas.
Maybe that was it. I don't know. But there was. I'd be interested to see how they treat the same subject matter. I was underwhelmed by Krampus. I'll say that. I didn't hate it. I didn't love it. I was mostly underwhelmed. I thought that some of the aesthetics were fun.
I think it works pretty damn well, and I think it works at a very cult level.
It's very culty. My number 6 is Room, starring Brie Larson. I think I reviewed this one on the episode I did with Leland. And I likened the movie a lot to Beasts of the Southern Wild. It reminded me of certain aspects of that, the sort of magic realism of that movie, treating sort of natural environments as if it's fantasy.
Okay.
And it also sort of reminded me a little bit of Terry Gilliam's Tidelands. It's an interesting movie, and it, you know, talks about very, very dark stuff, but from the perspective of the innocence of a child. And, you know, I think it gets into bigger questions without ever having to, like, hit you over the head with what does it all mean of it all. It's a performance-based film, both, you know, the main kid whose name I don't have in front of me right now, and Brie Larson, who I think gives a career best. And I love just the world that the director creates in such a contained environment.
Well, I mean, you've sold it to me more. I didn't know that it had like magic realism kind of quality to it.
I mean, I don't want to sell that, like oversell that. It is It's naturalized, but there's an aspect of it where you're seeing it from this kid's perspective, and he doesn't understand how dark and dismal everything is because she won't let him know. So he's kind of turned everything in his environment as kind of like, oh, you know, Mr. Toothbrush and Mr. Couch. And, you know, it's very, very much like Tideland in that way.
Okay. Well, to me, Brie Larson kind of sold it. She usually turns in at least one of these a year where she's in a small, underrated indie. So I'm sure if I saw this, it might have been at least in my honorable mention.
And this is the type of subject matter that could have so easily just been a Lifetime movie.
Sure.
And the fact that it isn't that, by, you know, a somewhat new director and, you know, not Meryl Streep in the lead, like somebody they kind of took a chance with. And it's I think it paid off.
Well, I will definitely check it out.
Cool.
Is Mad Max Fury Road. This is a movie I feel strange about. I'm a huge Road Warrior fan, the second film in the franchise. And so this film didn't necessarily strike a chord to some people, where it's like the golden god of cinema this year, apparently.
It's pretty high on your list, though.
It is. It's number 5. I love Mad Max. I'm not going to lie. it still did like have an impression on me.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's rated R, but I can barely say why. I mean, maybe it was kind of violent, but you know what? It felt like a big tentpole explosions happening movie. Now, it was the best of those, best way you can deliver that kind of movie possible way.
Yeah.
But it did kind of, I guess, some of those kind of big explosion qualities kind of, because I see movie week after week, kind of sometimes just don't necessarily deliver that much to me. There has to be a little bit more character interaction or other things happening in it for it to kind of get to me. But it's still a Mad Max movie. It was people driving cars, fast and violently, and people in cool makeup. And, I just love the world. I mean, there's something to really be said about George Miller being able to do that at his age. Mm-hmm. And I mean, doing a lot of this practically and giving a movie that a lot of people really loved from all kinds of sectors and all kinds of walks of life.
That's true. I'm astonished by the appeal of the huge appeal of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm beyond the fact that it's, you know, it brought in the people who love big spectacle blockbuster cinema. It brought in sort of the fanboy, like sci-fi horror fetishy kids. It also brought in like the film critics who were nominating it for best film of the year. Like I'm astonished by how much of a, like, you know, tri-quadrant hit this movie has become this year.
And I think it does earn it. I think it's a good movie. There was nothing of that. It was hard for when people were talking about it for me not to be like, oh, okay. it was really that great. Okay, good. Good. I'm glad you liked it. Right. I liked it too. I'm sorry I'm not as excited as you. But no, it did still come into my number five. I love me some Mad Max. I Charlize Theron's great in it. Tom Hardy's great in it. The villains are weird and scary. It's what it needs to be.
Mm-hmm. I enjoyed the movie immensely, especially as a technical piece. I think it is about as pure as cinema can get. You know, this is a movie, going back to our Hateful Eight review, this is a movie that should have been shot on 70.
Yeah, no, it's a crazy fucking movie, too, if you really look at it.
Right.
And the fact that it did kind of hit a lot of different quadrants and bring in enough people from each sector, it's pretty amazing. I can only imagine I think the next film, because I know they're going to do another one, with how much this one made and how well it did. I think it's going to be funny, because I don't think it's going to be in the same tone. I hope
no,
it's a
it
lot.
No, he changes almost every movie. He changes everything, yeah. Every way he conceives it. So, like, who knows? I mean, it could be, he could go back to the well to go with what works, but, because this is the only movie of the bunch that it's not really a cult film anymore.
Right.
Right.
Let's do Fast and the Furious, except on, like, and on steroids.
Right. In the middle of a blighted desert. No, I enjoyed the movie a lot. Again, it's an honorable mention. I think it's a little more surfacey than people make it out to be, but I think, agreed. Damn, is it a nice surface.
Yeah, agreed.
Okay, my number five is an early film from the year, but really stuck with me. I think one of the most atmospheric films of the year, and it's the indie horror It Follows. Mm. You know, it's sort of a throwback to sort of 80s slasher horror, specifically Carpenter films, the score.
Well, the score very much is part of that.
As a synthy kind of goblins inspired slash Carpenter inspired synthy score.
This is my number four.
Oh, okay.
So I'm going to throw my hat into at the same time.
Sure.
It, with the goblins bringing that up, it also is kind of, it's very aware of its horror roots. And it's very aware also of like, giallo kind of horror, like kind of Suspiria kind of heightened reality kind of fairy tale land sort of quality as well.
Right. Yeah. That, you know, it has a lot of atmosphere. I think it's a good movie to showcase a new actress in Micah Monroe, who I think we'll see more of. And yeah, I really, really got caught up in the mood of the movie, more than anything else. And I think that it's more subversive than people make it out to be. I think it's a pretty smart movie when it's talking about the effects of trauma on young, sexual experiences and how it affects you for the rest of your life and how it affects the people you end up meeting later down the road. And I think that it's, you know, as far as all of these new art house horrors that have been coming out, it's a standout among them.
Well, I think, too, I don't necessarily even think it has to be about trauma. I think that the film is smart, and I think that it is talking about just sexuality. I think you could even kind of just talk about sexuality in general.
Right, and loss of innocence.
Well, some of the pitfalls that can come with not being educated enough about it, or not really having an adult. There's like one scene with an adult in that whole film, and it's very purposeful. Well, there's two scenes. There's one scene where she's kind of crying for Micah Monroe's character, and then there's another scene that comes up in the film where it's a little bit more horror-ish. But the movie is the atmosphere, the narrative quality of it, the acting. I mean, talking about characters too, all the little like side like buddies in this, they're a lot of fun too. And the whole thing you get kind of sucked up into. And you kind of drift, you end up just going through the movie in a good way. You kind of drift through it in a good way.
It has almost kind of like a Goonies meets Dream Warriors quality to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just a little scarier and more messed up.
But right.
No, yeah. there is, I think that there is a smarter underlying quality about this film that people aren't really tapping into. Whether it just comes from what subject matter is talking about or not, I don't think matters either. I think that this film just alone, it just comes together in enough way that you can talk about it in it kind of inform you about something that maybe you didn't even think about your own, like, human sexuality. So.
Right. Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And it's masterfully shot by David Robert Mitchell, who directed this and wrote it. And he's so patient with the camera. He definitely took a lot of notes from Carpenter that, you know, he shoots things sparingly. He doesn't overshoot things, or he doesn't cut too much. He milks the drama from, you know, letting the camera sit for a while.
Well, there's these scenes where the camera, like, spins, like, in one place.
Yeah.
But it does it very slowly and methodically, and you see a lot of people.
Plays perspective very interestingly.
But it kind of, it does a couple of different things, because, first of all, it kind of just, like, informs you about, you know, the environment around you, which a lot of films can't do, and don't take the time to do that, and don't need to, quite frankly. But in this one, it kind of makes you kind of think about how we're all interacting with this subject matter. And, but then it also kind of adds to that paranoia of, oh, where's it coming from? So it's a very smart and well done movie, I think.
Yeah. And very economically made. Like, there's no fat on this.
Yeah. Again, that was my number four. So you can go into your number four.
My number four is, Denis Villeneuve's, Sicario or Sicario.
Sure.
I was floored by this movie.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I walked out of this thing with my jaw on the floor. Like, it, talk about atmosphere.
I try not to be, I mean, sometimes you just can't help it. I try not to give reviews that are gushy. Well, that are gushy, or that could be like a blurb. But
right.
But for this movie, like, it's really been stuck in my mind, and they can use this for a blurb. They wouldn't. But I'm just saying they could. I wouldn't care. It, to me, it's a slow motion heart attack, but in a good way. Like,
yes.
I was just like, oh shit. But it wasn't that necessarily the movie was, it wasn't moving at like a J.J. Abrams speed. It was moving very slowly and methodically.
Right.
But I was like the whole time at the edge of my seat, like, somebody's going to kill somebody. I know they're going to do it. It happens. But like, it's a very great movie.
Yeah,
I've got to make another confession.
Oh, is this your number three?
This is my number three, yeah.
Okay, good. Well, we'll get into it. But I love this movie. It's beautifully, beautifully shot by Roger Deakins, one of the best living cinematographers. And now that a few really famous cinematographers have died, like, the spot for number one is opening up pretty quick. And he might be it. And,
he's going to be doing Blade Runner with the same director.
And I'll be excited to, at the very least, look at it.
With Baby Goose.
Right. It kind of plays in familiar genre territory in talking about, like, it's kind of a noir to a certain extent. It's a sort of a border noir about a police officer who goes across the border and ends up, you know, taking on a world she wasn't prepared to take on. But the way Denis Villeneuve turns, this world of kind of cartel crime.
Well, it could be. I mean, this could be a very typical cartel kind of movie, and
right.
The way it ends up representing,
he turns it
Mexicans
into the nine circles
Mexican
of
Americans.
Hell.
Yeah, the way that he represents them though is not stereotypical or demeaning in any way. This isn't just another, you know, like we were talking about with Dope. Dope is not just another depiction of some street gangster kid. This isn't just another depiction of some, you know, Mexican cartel guys look tough and show up with their guns and blow shit away.
And it has some of the best kind of internal, intrinsic kind of directing that I've seen of, as far as like portraying a character's, nervousness in going into a situation and feeling what she's really feeling as she's going through it, since something like Silence of the Lambs.
Which I feel like our reviews are almost spot on to what they were when we watched it like 3 months ago. And that was 3 months ago.
Yeah.
I think that's how much it, like, the holding power it has. Specifically, you know, talking about Emily Blunt in this, talking about Benicio del Toro, talking about
Josh Brolin. All three of which give career best performances.
Oh, yeah. And you were talking about Denis Villeneuve. This, he can control a narrative like...
Mm-hmm.
Like nobody's business. This is a film showcasing that.
Right.
And I have a feeling that it's going to get kind of shortchanged. I just haven't been hearing a lot about it, but I think this is a very strong and very, I think it should be an important film, because I really do think the way that it portrays that cartel and that border and that whole society and culture and the way we look at it and feel about it, I think is really, really smart and interesting.
Mm-hmm. On top of the fact that just on a genre level, just a, you know, as a thriller, this is how you do it.
Agreed.
Like this, you know, I can't think of a tighter tightrope to walk across for the length of the film. It's just you hang on every single moment. And like you said, there's not a lot of big moments as far as like, you know, the cathartic violence or anything like that. He really holds it, but you're invested the entire time.
Oh yeah, it's just you're there.
You know that you are in a dangerous world the entire time, and that anything, you know, the possibility of violence is around every corner.
Well, the mystery factor of the film too, because there is a bit of that, just
and
mystery
paranoia.
Surrounding and paranoia,
yeah.
Is just it's palpable. You can taste it, you can feel it. This is a film that I really recommended, and for some reason nobody wants to go see it.
People don't believe me, but I'm like, no, it's one of the best films of the year. They're like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm like, no, go.
Yeah, nobody wants to. They're like, it just looks like another cartel movie. Well, it kind of is, but it's just the best one I've probably seen, period.
Right.
I mean, honestly. Anyways, I can't really laud this movie enough. It's a near perfect film. Probably.
I agree. My number three is Ex Machina. I feel like our lists are getting pretty similar at this point, aren't they?
Yeah.
Is that your number two?
Oh yeah.
That's okay. Ex Machina, directed by and written by Alex Garland, who previously had written for Danny Boyle, who I mentioned earlier in the list. And here he's taking on kind of a Philip K. Dickian sort of existential sci-fi thriller. And Oscar Isaac and Domhnall Gleeson and Alicia Vikander play the three leads in this. Again, another, sort of another chamber piece. We've been talking about that a lot lately. About, Domhnall Gleeson has to prove that this droid created by this crazy hermit scientist played by Oscar Isaac, is it really have human intelligence, or is it just a really, really well designed program?
Well, what is the difference? Also, there's sort of a fairy tale quality,
right?
Is what I kind of responded to it. There's a really Bluebeard, Pinocchio, just sort of strangeness to it, but it's done in a very adult way. And also, you're watching Oscar Isaac and Brendan Gleeson. They're just.
You mean Domhnall?
Domhnall Gleeson, yeah,
yeah.
Sorry.
Little Gleeson.
Yeah, Little Gleeson. But again, I'm in love with Oscar Isaac right now, so it's hard for me not to fixate on him. But in general,
he's had a very good year.
Yeah, everybody in this turns in a great performance.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say the lead actress's name for my life.
Alicia Vikander.
Yeah, sure. She's not. She gives a great performance, but there's kind of a weird sensuality to her. But I mean, if you've seen the film or you've even seen the poster, you know that she's strapped down. She's in this metallic kind of, you know, almost iPhone-y kind of quality. But it's this sleek sensuality, but it's partly her performance. She entices you. She seduces you in mm-hmm. the film. There's also kind of a thriller quality to it that I really responded to. I think what we share as kind of film goers a little bit is sometimes we share a quality where why we're responding to these like chamber pieces is because it's counter programming. And I think we kind of respond to the counter programming more than the whatever's popular at the moment.
Right. Well, I like to be surprised by film. And I think what this film and Sicario and It Follows and a lot of these movies that I've mentioned, what they kind of have in common is that they take chances and they surprise me. And a lot of them, function on this waiting for the other shoe to drop the story. And you know that as soon as Domhnall Gleeson enters this weird tech mansion in the middle of nowhere, he's entering a shady environment where any number of things could go poorly.
And Oscar Isaac is threatening.
Yeah, well, at the same time.
Even when he dances with robots.
Even when he dances with robots. But at the same time, is also very charismatic and very funny. And this movie, right. Like, balances tone in a really interesting way where it's kind of cold and Kubrickian at the same time, allowing for this, like, really casual kind of wry sense of humor.
Well, Alex, his last name I just missed.
Garland.
Alex Garland. I really felt when this movie was coming, I was like, no, this is really going to show him, because I feel like he was one of those writers
mm-hmm.
where you're really getting a lot from him. And so seeing him step in a more filmic way, because I mean, he was also a big part of why Dredd was great. He was a big reason why, you know, a lot of the films that he's been a part of have been great. Mm-hmm. And not to say that any of those directors involved weren't good or great at what they did at their craft, but he brings an extra something. And I think that it really showed what type of auteur. And another thing, you were talking about the quality of all these, you know, It Follows and all these films. Something that really came up to me was the fact that all these films are on well-trodden ground. Mm-hmm. None of these films are necessarily like, we can say like, oh, they're kind of Philip K. Dickian or they're this or they're this, but they are still taking and they show, no, you can still do stuff with this. This isn't just, you don't have to do it in the same way. Just because there was one, you know, just because we did Blade Runner great this way doesn't mean everything that comes out of Blit, you know, everything that's Philip K. Dickian has to be like Blade Runner. We can show it in a different angle. We can do it in a different way. And this is one of those films. It delivers. Mm. It's great performances. It's great atmosphere and build. Again, I felt very, you like you said, as soon as you get into the interior of this place, you feel threatened.
Yeah, you know that there's a clock that's ticking.
Yeah, it's going somewhere and somewhere not pleasant.
And it's largely just, you know, a movie full of long conversation set pieces of them trying to interview this robot and get data from it and information from each other. But the mind games that are played between the three leads here, again, you could almost do this like a play. I love this movie. And I haven't seen it since. I need to see it again.
It holds up.
But go ahead. What's your number one?
My number one is Inside Out.
And that would be my number two.
Okay. No. Inside Out is just, I don't know. I was like, it's weird because there are only so many reviews that I remember parts of my review. Mm-hmm. And because I try to make mine very conversational and I don't really necessarily try to over intellectualize it. I try to make it very like just conversational. Like this is how you would talk about it. But Inside Out, I remember I wasn't prepared to be a 12-year-old girl or a 14-year-old girl. Like the emotions that came through me and oh my gosh, it almost destroyed me. I'm not a very emotional person. I don't like to get mushy and gushy, and it's not just because I'm like tough. I'm not that tough. It's not necessarily within my nature very much. I'm just not a sentimental person. Mm. But this film, it touched me, and it really did move me. And the way that they play on the heartstrings and the way that they make you feel and think about life and growing up and even kind of the differences between us, it's a profound fucking movie. And it's by Pixar, and it's made for, you know, 10-year-olds.
Yeah.
And it's by far one of, I think, probably the most profound movie to come out this year. And I don't care what people can make fun of me. I think that's true.
No, I would agree. I think this is another one where I was unprepared for how good it was. And I think, you know, it is kind of like an emotional exposed nerve. I watched this again over Christmas with my family. And it was kind of like a loud Christmas household with like kids running around and people like talking over each other and that kind of stuff. And even in that environment, watching it on a big screen in a living room, there was like, I almost cried like three times. Like, no movie I can think of has like, maybe with the exception of a couple, have never like really gotten to the heart of what it feels like to be a child dealing with emotions for the first time. And not knowing where they're coming from and not knowing exactly how to deal with them yet before you've come up with all of your thousands of defense mechanisms to get you through life. And you know, it does a really good job at like showing how those defense mechanisms are built. One of the things I appreciate about the movie the most is how structurally complicated it is and how much like, you know, shoots and ladders narratively has to be accomplished to even tell this story. If you just try and explain the mythology of, oh, here's these emotions and they each do this thing, then they control these islands and there's these blue balls and these, you know, different glowing orbs that have different emotions in them and they control these different things. Like there is so much here that would just explaining it to someone would bore them to sleep. But the fact that they're able to do all of that and be able to still make you not only feel some emotion, but break your heart.
Well, to be
is incredible.
And also to be somewhat accurate about how feelings work, mm-hmm. and to be like, I mean, not completely anatomical because there's not like a, you know, a pink elephant man living in your head. Well, maybe not. But
don't speak for everybody.
Okay, fair enough. I'm sorry, blanket statement. But what I'm saying is, I mean, even as an adult, there are things you can take away from, because, I mean, I still feel like even as an adult, sometimes you're kind of still kind of like learning to grasp feelings, right, learning to deal with what they mean and how they function in you. I think something that it talks about on the periphery is because we see other people's, we see a lot of other people's insides at just little brief moments. Mm-hmm. It kind of tells you, even though this is about somebody else, like, even though it's kind of like your hero's journey in a weird way, it's still saying, like, it's okay to have those different, like, unknowns. And sometimes you're going to have these kind of difficulties. Like, and honestly, like, I don't know. Just thinking about the complexities of the film and how it kind of deduces it into this fun pop narrative is almost staggering. Like, right. I feel like I'm being like too verbose, but I really do mean it.
No, I completely agree. I think that it's a really high for Pixar, who's kind of been, you know, a little for the last few years, and this is such a strong comeback. And maybe in part that's why we're maybe more excited about it than we would be if this had followed, you know, an Up or a Wall-E or something like that, another one of their highs. But sure. I really think this stands up against anything in their cataloging.
Oh, I think it's their best.
And I'm
a big fan of the two you mentioned.
Right. And it has a universality that you're talking about, that you can, anybody from any culture can watch this without being cynically universal in a, like, we can make money from anywhere kind of way.
Right. It helped me in a weird way. And I can't even describe how. Necessarily, because it didn't necessarily describe anything I didn't know. Mm-hmm. It just said it in a way clear enough that I just felt better about the world.
Right.
Like,
I agree with you. There's a catharsis to it. And I've heard somebody just say, I think they were interviewing Pete Docter, who wrote it and directed it. They said that they wouldn't be surprised if people end up using the language of this movie to describe things to their therapist for years to come.
It's my number one. I don't know if I can speak higher of it. So,
all right. Well, I only have one movie left in my list. And the only movie that I can think of that topped all the above and was sitting here from pretty early on.
Mm-hmm.
And I even when I saw it, I was like, I don't know if I'm going to see a better movie this year.
Okay, let's see.
Is a Ukrainian film I saw earlier this year called The Tribe.
Okay.
And now this came out in 2014 over there, and then hit the festival circuit around 2014, but it was released officially in 2015 in America. So I consider it a 2015 film. This movie stayed in my brain forever, and still does. Like, it, you know, the world that it creates, I'll try and pronounce this director's name, Miroslav Sobolashkapitsky. Very Eastern European.
I'm not going to help you with that one.
Yeah. You know, the basic premise of the movie being that there's this kind of a prep school or a boarding school with all of these deaf students who live in this sort of Lord of the Flies society of their own, where they've been pretty much ignored by their teachers, by other adults. When we watched this, it's another film I saw in a film class, and we kind of got to see it a little bit early before it was released in theaters. But when I watched this, the way I described it is there's something apocalyptic about this movie. And Lord of the Flies is a good way of describing sort of the culture of these students at this film. And, you know, it's all in sign language, there's no subtitles, and none of the characters actually speak a word of dialogue. You hear some, like, grunts and noises and stuff they make as they're, like, arguing with each other. But you don't even really need the subtitles. You kind of get just expressively what they're saying and what they mean for each other. You understand, like, oh, he's the leader and he's the follower and he's trying to overtake the leader. And these are these, you know, here's the girls that they're turning into sex slaves so that they can make all this money underneath the teacher's noses. And it goes into some really dark, really disturbing places dealing with teenagers. And it pulls you into this bleak. I can't think of another film that I've seen this year that's more bleak than this. And more affecting and more heartbreaking, but also terrifying. It, you know, the ending of this movie is one of those. You're even right now, apparently, I'm still speechless.
I said you sign. Maybe that'll help.
I guess I have to. It's beyond words. This movie I just thought was, usually if I look at the history of what I pick for my number one, It's if I see a film that I see is exploring the language of film, if not in a way I've never seen before, at least in subverting ways I've seen before. And in this one in particular, you know, it depends on the language of film to tell the story. You have to be able to read what's going on without dialogue to move the story. Well, and it does so without you even realizing halfway through that you haven't heard a word of dialogue.
Well, that's sort of very interesting. And I think necessarily something that sometimes people just don't tap into the visual language of cinema, which is sort of strange to me, because that's, I mean, why are you watching a movie then? I know it's just entertainment, but beyond that too, like, I'm glad you didn't say a film we've seen, because if you tried to do something we'd seen that wasn't Inside Out, I would have had to cut you down and boo you down. So no, you're done. You've ended us. This is the last time we'll ever. But I'm interested. I know this is a film that you lauded to me a while ago. I just haven't had the opportunity to see it still. But
I haven't seen this since. It'd be interesting to see how it holds up or whatever. But I just, it stayed in my brain and sloshed around there for months and months after. And it's like I said, very dark, very unapologetically nihilistic in its depiction of humanity, left with, you know, when people are left to their own devices, when youth are left to their own devices, and it becomes sort of an animal savage culture.
Well, yeah, you leave us. I mean, you just leave anybody in the room for
to an life. Already marginalized society of deaf people. So it's, yeah, it, and this movie. I really don't have words for it, apparently, other than, you know, see it when you can, if you can stomach it.
Lord of the... So, I mean, I guess what I'm kind of getting away from this, too, is, like, what I wanted to ask is this something that really is going to appeal to, like, your broader audience, like your big tentpole kind of people, or is this something for more your cinema kind of literate people?
I mean, if it's a one or the other, it's probably not going to appeal to the broader audience who want to walk away from a movie feeling good, mm-hmm. and who'd rather not be challenged. You know, if you can't get through the first 10 minutes of 2001 Space Odyssey, then you might have a hard time with this movie. But I think that, you know, if you're patient with it and you allow yourself to get, transfixed by this world that he's created, which I said it's like reality, but it's not. It's almost so, and maybe this is just my, like, American, I live so far away from it that I can't perceive it as reality when it's very much a lot of people's reality. I saw it as like an apocalyptic film. In the way, because, and it's another one like It Follows where you almost never see an adult.
Yeah.
In this group of these kids. And in a way, it kind of reminded me of Larry Clark's Kids in that way. It's a tough film, but I think it's vital, and it has a lot of a raw energy to it.
Maybe not as crazy as, like, something maybe like Dogtooth.
It's sort of in that world. It's like in that, I mean, it's not as idiosyncratic, and it's not as intentionally satirical. I think that it's there's a little bit more natural drama in it, but yeah, I mean, it's if that's your reference point, that's not a terrible one.
Oh no, I'm just trying to kind of be like, oh, kind of dictate, because I haven't seen the film, obviously, yeah. And so I can't really have a dialogue about it, but I am interested in it, so I want to kind of like oh, because I sometimes it's good to walk into a film to be surprised, and sometimes it can be very bad. I feel like, I think you need to know it enough so that you're not relying on certain expectations. But
right.
So I'm just, you know, I'm curious about it, and I'd definitely give it a shot. So
yeah, I mean, I put it on my number one spot for two purposes: one, because of the power it had on me, mm-hmm. and two, because of the what it's accomplishing technically without me like overanalyzing it as I'm watching it.
Sure.
So, but that's
that elemental kind of feel right. for a movie, right? Okay.
Well, and cool. that is our top tens of 2015. And we'll just go over a bottom, but we don't have to like spend a lot of time on them. We can kind of rattle them off because we're a little long in the tooth again. But these are my bottom five. You can tell me if you disagree with any of this.
Okay.
For number five, I have M. Night Shyamalan's The Visit. I saw what he was going for. I didn't think he accomplished it. Thought it was mostly annoying. Not a fan.
It hit kind of more medium for me just because I kind of did actually... The horror film he was telling, I dug that film.
Yeah.
The other like three type of movies he was making there, I didn't as much. So it was more of a middling film for me, truthfully.
Right. Jurassic World is my number four. A much bigger movie than The Visit, and obviously made boatloads of money up until, I think, Star Wars. It was the highest grossing movie ever. And I just felt like it was a gigantic toy commercial for the original Jurassic Park, which I would rather watch.
I know that you came away from it feeling, I liked the first chunk. And then by the end, I pretty much agree with you. I think the ending is horrible. I really do. And I think that people are just kind of glossing over and not really talking about that. But,
I think the best thing you can say about it is that it's bland.
I kind of liked the first part. I thought Chris Pratt was pretty charismatic. Again, to me, it was just more of a middling movie. There was no strong hate. I understand your strong hate. You usually have at least one blockbuster like that a year. So,
was
to me, it felt very typical. I was like, oh yeah, he'll hate that.
This is mine. Number three, I have, for bottom of the year, Unfriended, the haunted Skype call okay. horror movie. I think I praised it at the time for being kind of experimental and that it seemed to completely reject the notion of cinematic language. And that's vaguely interesting, but it's also super boring and not scary at all and really unmemorable and I think a little lazy.
I didn't see it, and it sounds like the commercial. Like, I mean, I felt like I got that from the commercial.
Right.
So, I mean, I know that it's your job to go see it, and you probably did see this for the paper, but... Oh. Yeah, that was definitely not something I was willing to undertake.
And you probably weren't willing to undertake my number two either, which was 50 Shades of Grey.
I almost did.
I think almost anything I could say at this point about this movie is redundant. I don't think I'm going to see the other ones when they eventually come.
But they're about sex. They're adult, Cassidy.
Right.
That's how you tried to get me in. That's how you tried to get me in, motherfucker.
I was interested. I'll say this. I was interested to see what a mainstream movie that has the only thing about it that's appealing, the only thing that's the draw to it is that it's a big sex film. It's a big, you know, erotic movie. I thought that was interesting because it's so against the grain of what culture is now,
mm-hmm.
which is usually to play everything as safe as possible. And of course, this movie plays with its themes as safe as it can. It rides that edge before it turns into something, you know, your 45-year-old mother can blush at. But it's, no.
My mom wouldn't blush. I've been tricked by it before, by those kind of, like, ideas, and I won't be tricked again by it. I knew what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you came back, you're like, well, I was like, yep, I did that once. It was called Twilight. It's called Twilight.
And you did that more than once. You did that four times.
Yes, I did. And it was also because I was working at the theater and because I kept harassing all the girls who worked there and were reading it. And so I was like, fine. You're like, well, then you should just try it. And I was like, okay, I will try it. And I did. And it was bad.
And lastly, the worst film I saw in 2015, and I wonder if it's on your list, is unfortunately Michael Mann's Black Hat, which was a mess. And not a very good-looking one, and one of the worst performances from Chris Hemsworth, and super boring.
It is on my list. We'll get to that. I don't necessarily usually see as many movies as you, and I don't know. I just don't necessarily have a fervor But I usually end up at least with like a few that I'm like, no, oh, fuck that film. This year it was a little harder. You almost even ended up with Tomorrowland, which I would have ended up kind of defending because it was still a middling movie to me. But right. I ended up with a decent list. A decent. Okay. In the Heart of the Sea, I chose. Chris Hemsworth's fine. There's some Wells. It's really kind of a middling movie too, I will say. But overall, it's kind of just it stands for that pretentious kind of film that comes out around award season time. That's forgotten and kind of just washed over within a year, even within a few weeks. Mm-hmm. Like, I just don't, again, there's some great performances. I always think Chris Hemsworth's, he's a charismatic leading man, and mm-hmm. he isn't. But the film overall is just kind of lackluster, and the further I get away from it, the more I'm like, oh yeah, that Well movie that happened. I even have a hard time remembering the name. My number four was Black Mass.
Okay. Bad year for Chris Hemsworth.
No, this is Black Mass.
Oh!
This is the Johnny Depp movie.
You're right.
This is The Departed Light. It felt like a bad, like History Channel, like, reenactment knockoff. Just done with really, like, big stars.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't really, like, mesh very well. And it kind of, I mean, I had to keep making fun of it to kind of even keep myself engaged with the film, to like pay attention is what I mean.
Yeah.
So I kept calling, what's his face? Johnny Depp, Irish Dracula.
Mm-hmm.
Because I mean, he kind of looked like that too. The makeup job was just weird,
right.
Weird offsetting choice, but I don't think that the film was very good.
It's kind of nondescript. It just kind of sat there.
Yeah, and I mean, to have that many people in it, and kind of, I also kind of feel weird about it, because kind of the hype machine was kind of saying, oh yeah, it's good. But my overall takeaway was, why didn't I just watch The Departed again? Like, I mean, I heard it that way. It kind of also brings me back to what, like, film, cinema, and stories are. Like, just because something isn't necessarily, like, completely accurate, doesn't mean that it's less truthful, because this movie, even though that it was more accurate, quote unquote, it wasn't necessarily more truthful,
right, to the historical account of Whitey Bulger. Yeah,
well, it could be more historically accurate to Whitey Bulger, but it didn't necessarily tell you anything. It was just people doing stuff. I think that The Departed is a more elemental and has more going on than it. Even if you wanted to try to be very historically accurate, I don't think you'd get a better version. And Black Mass kind of proves that. No, my number three is Black Hat. Not a good year for non-Marvel entity Chris Hemsworth stuff.
Yeah, even with that said, his Marvel entry this year in Avengers Age of Ultron, while Avengers Age of Ultron did not end up on my bad list, it might be on my biggest disappointment list.
It was middling. I have to see it again. I honestly came out of the movie and was like, what the hell just happened at my face? I kind of still feel that way. Like, I really didn't get anything out of that film. I need to sit down with it again. I will, because I like big superhero dumb stuff. I like it. I mean, it's not necessarily even my version of superheroes. I've always liked the, like, street level stuff. But I only like Joss Whedon, and I'll give it another shot. But Black Hat was just a lifeless, it was weird, because I'm watching a director I actually really like
mm-hmm.
do the worst version of a movie he could. And so it feels, there's these weird tinges of wanting to like it, because it's like, because there's weird familiar markers.
Yeah.
But then it just doesn't do anything. There was kind of some moments that it entered in, but there's the scene where they're in between all these people and they're kind of going, and that kind of worked for a second, but just the way it ended up being shot on this weird, like, pixelated fucking digital look, yeah. It seems very like, there doesn't seem to be a reason, or at least one I can tell, and I don't think it really works. Also, like, there's a lot of, it just feels like it could have been cut, like, at least an hour out of the movie, and it would have been better. And I don't even know if that would have saved it. It just wasn't very good. My number two was Jupiter Ascending.
All right, that was on my bad list, but it didn't make my bottom five, ultimately because it was entertainingly bad.
I will somewhat agree, but then I think of some of the performances by people that are doing pretty decent right now, and I'm just like, no, it was kind of terrible. Like, when I kind of come down to it, I was just like, no, it was just bad. This is a bloated blockbuster, you know, in a year where we're going to have another Star Wars film. You can't help but look at this and say, okay, I wanted to give them points for being original, but everything else about the movie undercut it.
Mm-hmm.
Everything positive gets buried by how bad it is. And I mean, it also comes down to retrospect. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, I do think it kind of comes down to disappointment factor as well. Because again, it was original. When I saw the previews and there was weird shit happening, I was like, good, something weird. Let's try that.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just was just a bunch of malarkey baloney.
And you're like, never mind.
Yeah. Well, it was just a lot of CG stacked on CG and nothing really. Well, there was a lot of nonsense happening. And I don't mean nonsense like as just like being vague. I mean, literal nonsense was happening. Like, nothing connected. Like, it was just like, oh, the blarpity blarp did this to the blarpity blarp. You're like, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. Okay. So it is sort of entertaining. So I will give you that. It is sort of an entertaining failure, but it's not good.
Like, if I'm ever feeling down,
yeah,
and I'm in the car and I'm stuck in LA traffic and I'm thinking about all the bills I haven't paid yet and I'm just feeling really, really down, all I have to do is think about Eddie Redmayne and Jupiter Ascending, and it puts a big old smile on my face.
Well, you could do that and then mix it with the Stevie Hawking movie he was in. You get a whole strange experience. It's the same movie, man, I'm telling you. My number one was Terminator Genesis.
Oh, that was bad. Is that on my list? Where the fuck is that?
I don't know if that... Well, see, I was surprised that wasn't on your list. Because that actually, some of these I could actually think of like, okay, there's kind of this is happening and I'm being a little too bitchy about this and this is in retrospect. That movie's just a piece of shit. Like, there's no like ifs, ands, or buts about it. And the sad thing is that it did very well, not in the US, not domestically, but worldwide. So there'll probably be another one. But the acting was terrible. The direction was just off and nothing connected. It was truly a terrible film. It wasn't redeemable in the fact that it was somewhat entertaining. It was just bad. Like, even the things that you would be like, okay, maybe Arnie's in it, so it'll just make it so bad it's good in some ways, it wasn't. He was just kind of awkward. And the film, I forgot his name, because he really shouldn't be a name in general, but the guy that played Kyle Reese is just, he just should not be in stuff.
Jai Courtney.
Oh, that's his name.
And Jason Clark is in there as well. And
because Jason Clark is a good damn.
He's good. But no, yeah, that movie.
The Game of Thrones chick, she can be okay. But Jai Courtney was definitely, I mean, everything about that movie was an anchor.
He's a charisma vacuum, yeah.
But to be an anchor on an anchor is not a good sign. So I
think that I completely forgot to put that. That would have to be in my top five. I think that might. Yeah, I think that would at least bump out The Visit. Congratulations, Visit. You are no longer in my bottom five. You have been replaced by Terminator Genesis.
Yeah, right. And they didn't spell that right. They spell it for no apparent reason.
One of the worst trailer reveals, like spoiler, in the middle of their trailer that hinges on everything about the movie when you go see it.
Oh, yeah. It could have been... No, it couldn't have been. I'm lying to myself.
It still would have been bad, but at least I would have had that surprise.
Would have had something, but I wonder, too, if I would have seen it and go, oh, okay. Or I would have just read through it and been like, oh, he's the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, Alan Taylor needs to go back to HBO. They're giving him the bottom of the barrel, and he's just kind of, there's something about TV directors. They kind of are company men because they have to be in that world because they're not the high on the totem pole. And so he's going to keep getting schlock like this, and he's coming in at the last second, and he's always going to make these dreamy things that can make a great TV episode because it's 45 minutes. But as a fucking movie, oh my gosh, it was kind of torturous. Like, looking back on it, it was torturous. It hurt. It hurt to watch this film.
Yeah, I maybe didn't hate it quite as much as you did, but it was, I it's so bad I forgot it existed.
I don't feel like I'm even being bitchy.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I'm just being like very much, no, that was shit. I shouldn't watch this film. It shouldn't have existed. And I think that kind of ups the ante for me is the fact that it did very well worldwide, yeah, and that it does have a possibility of going on to be a sequel.
Yeah.
That's something to really chew on.
Huh.
You know what? Black Hat, not going to see another one. Not going to see a sequel to that. Well, maybe direct to DVD or something, but I would be okay with that. But this is going to have a big film release baloney fest. I'm not here for it. Not here for it. So that's my bottom five.
All right. Well, yeah, that's it. That's the show. And I hope that everybody who's listening, if you haven't seen any of the movies that we talked about in our top 10, definitely go back and check those out. I think probably more than half of them are on DVD and Blu-ray now or streaming online.
Most of them, yeah.
And don't see any of the movies in our bottom five if you haven't already.
Yeah, you don't need to. I mean, if you just want to like prove your point, then go for it. Yeah. I want you to go watch them. Suffer like I suffered. That's what I want.
I'm not going to read out the normal garbage that I do at the end, other than tell people check out our, you know, jabberinthedrone.podbean.com to see our other archives.
And have a happy new year. And if you listen to us routinely, we appreciate you. And we hope you enjoy everything.
Yep. Talk to you later.
Have a good one. Bye.
Bye.